good evening. I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you for joining us this evening on Health Matters. April, spring is here, and it is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And for this Health Matters, we are hosting a live community forum on sexual assault in the Marion and Donald Weiss Performance Hall here at Red River Radio Studios. We will be taking your questions this evening from our studio audience as well as our listening audience. So you can call in questions at 1-800-552-8502. I'd also like to advise our listeners that the nature of this show is adults and listener discretion is advised. Everyone needs to be aware that an American is sexually assaulted every 98 seconds. That means one out of six American women and about a third of American men have been the victim of an attempted or completed sexual assault. Data shows that one in five women and one in 16 men report being sexually assaulted while in college. These are very staggering numbers. And to provide us with information about this important topic tonight, we have an excellent panel this evening. I'd like to welcome Ms. Grace Nichols. She is the Director of Student Advocacy and Accountability and Title IX Coordinator here at Louisiana State University in Shreveport.
Thank you.
Also, Angie Pellerin, Mental Health Counselor here with Counseling Services at Louisiana State University in Shreveport.
Glad to be here.
Angela Henderson, Project Celebration Sexual Assault Program Director.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Melanie Hubbard, Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner, Forensic Nurse Examiners.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melanie. Mr. Detective Michael Jones with the Shreveport Police Department Sex Crimes Division.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. And we have a survivor here. Her name is Ashley. Ashley, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you.
So I'd like to also thank our studio audience. You guys are here and you're in the studio with our first ever Health Matters that is a community forum. So this is a live audience that we have here tonight. And the listeners are also encouraged to call in as usual. The number for your calls, it's 1-800-552-8502. Are we live on Twitter? Everyone else seems to be these days. Should I give the Twitter address? At RRR Public Radio. So you can tweet a question as well. I'd like to go ahead and start the panel with sort of the definition, if you will, of what sexual assault is, because we hear terms that, you know, are mentioned. They may be casually mentioned or they may be mentioned in a very serious nature. So from the criminal standpoint, Detective, how would you distinguish some of the terms that we have discussed leading up to this show? Assault, battery, discrimination, harassment, things along those lines of a sexual nature.
Sexual assault is more of a broad term that covers any kind of unwanted touching, maybe it's digital, or it also covers pornography, molestation, crimes of those natures. Rape is another term that we use. It actually deals with penetration. And then there's also the term that's used that is sexual harassment. That's usually language that's used in a work environment that's of the nature that would cause somebody to be harassed.
And from the legal standpoint, I'm sort of making the assumptions if you become involved, then someone is breaking the law or
Correct.
Potentially breaking the law regarding these issues.
They either have or we believe they have. Yes, sir.
Okay. Angela, from your standpoint, you know, can you tell us a little bit about Project Celebration? What brought you to where you are today with this program? And congratulations on a very successful program, and we're happy to have you with us tonight.
Thank you. Project Celebration home base is in Manny, Louisiana, and it started in 1980 when a lot of concerned moms got together because the kids were having drug parties. So I started off as an education piece to teach the kids how to have safe and healthy fun. And as issues evolved, that's how the program evolved. So now we have a domestic violence and a sexual assault component as well.
And so how do you guys engage the community with Project Celebration?
Well, we have a couple of hotlines. We have five outreach offices in seven parishes, Cattle, Bossier, Webster, DeSoto, Natchitoches, and Red River and Sabine. And we also have Facebook, Twitter, I don't think Snapchat. I don't think we're that fancy yet, but.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being here. Grace, from the standpoint of Title IX, tell us a little bit about what is Title IX and what is your role in terms of being a Title IX coordinator at a university?
Sure. So Title IX comes from the Educational Amendments of 1972, and it was implemented to end sex discrimination at any educational institution or program that was receiving federal financial assistance. The common misperception was that it was implemented and referred only to gender equity in athletics programs, but it is much broader than that and applies to all sex discrimination and sexual misconduct. So as of April 2011, there was a Dear Colleague letter that indicated all colleges and universities, all public colleges and universities, needed to designate a Title IX coordinator. And that person was in place or is in place at each institution to make sure that there is training available to the campus, there's educational programming, other types of prevention and awareness efforts, as well as policies and procedures to address allegations of sexual misconduct in a fair and equitable manner.
So basically, you're present in the university to ensure that the university is compliant with the Title IX program.
Correct. All right, and we work with other offices within the institution, as well as Project Celebration and outside agencies, to make sure that we are offering a robust program for our students.
And I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot, but is there data that looks to see whether the implementation of Title IX policies has been effective in terms of reducing sexual violence on school campuses?
Sure. Colleges and institutions have to comply with the Clery Act, which includes an annual safety and security report that is made public. So we do have that on our website. And you can see a slight increase in the numbers over the past couple of years. And that I think that is because we have been more proactive in educating our community. And so we've received more reports because people know where to go. So it doesn't necessarily mean that there's any more misconduct happening now than there has been in the past. But students and faculty and staff are just more aware of how to report and what their rights are.
Yeah, so always a difficult issue in any sort of field, especially medical fields, in terms of what a baseline incidence is if you're going to actually detect a disease or a disorder. The reporting is very important. Angie, thank you for being here tonight. What's your role as a mental health counselor here at LSUS in as it pertains to this important topic?
Well, as a mental health counselor, we certainly are available to students who have been through a sexual assault experience. I do work closely with Grace for programming on education, awareness, prevention efforts, as well as Angela and all the Project Celebration advocates. They're wonderful, and they help us with programming to educate our students. As Grace mentioned, with that, sometimes we do get people who come forward, come to a counseling office for help with that. Sometimes it's the messaging that we have out on campus that might bring them in, because about 90% of college sexual assaults are not reported. So we're hoping that number will change eventually. That's a national number. So I do work with students who have experienced that. Sometimes it's not recent. It might be in their past. That comes up when they come in for something else. I try to just be that non-judging, accepting, listening person to help them through the traumatic experience that they're dealing with. Studies show that victims of sexual assault over the next 2 weeks following have about 80% of them have PTSD. And then it's still a third of them will remain with PTSD symptoms for 9 months after it happens if they haven't gotten any help for it. So we are there for that.
So PTSD, that's post-traumatic stress disorder.
Correct.
And we'll perhaps we can get into that a little bit more later in the
show.
Melanie, thank you so much for joining us. Let us know a little bit about what your role is as a forensic nurse.
Well, we're a small group of nurses. We're a nonprofit organization. We respond to the ER, to the emergency rooms, and we perform the evidence exam and evidence collection and interviews on anybody that has been sexually assaulted or domestic violence.
So when an incident occurs, your group is notified and you report immediately to the victim's location.
Yes, sir.
Okay, excellent service. I'd like to remind those listening on the air, this is Health Matters here at listener-supported Red River Radio. You can call and ask a question about our important topic tonight. It's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. We also have a live studio audience with us tonight, and I'm going to remind you guys that you can also ask questions. If you'd like to ask a question, simply raise your hand, and our producer, Renee, will bring the microphone to you, and you'll be able to ask your question to us here live as well as over the air. Angela, let's get back into the psychology of sexual assault a little bit. And in our discussions about this, you mentioned the neural response, or the brain's response to sexual trauma, and the fight or flight. But there's also a couple of other F's in there as well. Could you tell us a little bit about how the brain responds to these traumatic events?
Right. Besides fight or flight, there's also the freeze response. In my work with victims, a lot of times there's so much confusion because they froze up and they think, this is, with the things that they've said to me, I didn't do anything. I could have fought. I could have done something, and I didn't. So they're really confused about that. But the freeze response is another survival mechanism that sometimes is if you can't escape or if you're overpowered, that's how you survive. And so I can explain that to them, and they kind of are reassured by the fact that they didn't and weren't able to move and escape.
And the other F, the fawn, tell us what is that about?
The fawn response is also known as the please response. This is typically comes afterward. It can we see that victims of sexual assault have a much higher rate of being re-victimized in the future. And that often is whatever happens in the brain that creates this fawn response. There's behaviors, they tend to be self-sacrificing, and sometimes perpetrators will target that. There's a vulnerability that they see there, and so typically in the future they are much higher rate of being re-victimized if they don't get help, and we work with that with the brain, the neuroscience in there.
And so there's a lot of research that's actually been done on early childhood trauma and that victimization profile that tends to occur.
Exactly.
Can you speak a little bit more about that? What maybe people should be aware of out there, in particular parents, individuals who know children who may, be at early risk for developing the post-traumatic effects of issues related to childhood trauma, especially sexual trauma, correct?
Right. Yeah, it can, not always, but it can create that cycle of maybe finding someone's in an abusive relationship in the future. That codependence that we kind of see, that can occur when that's at early learning age when the brain is still developing. That's develops with the neural pathways. It goes straight to the amygdala, the emotional core of the brain sometimes. And so that can, not always, but can lead to a future with replaying those scenarios.
Yeah, that's very interesting psychology. We do have a psychologist, we do have a number of excellent psychologists here in Shreveport as well. And I think, the psychological help of the long-term issues after trauma, it tends to, I think, be easily overlooked when someone appears to be fully recovered from an event. Mm-hmm. But those long-term effects are,
yeah,
are very
important. Yeah,
they
can be easily triggered.
Right, absolutely.
And about a third contemplate suicide. And I think maybe it's 13% actually attempt suicide, survivors of sexual assault.
13%. So this is listener-supported Red River Radio. You're listening to Health Matters tonight. We are in the Red River Radio studio, and we have a live studio audience here tonight participating in a community forum on sexual assault, because April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. We have a survivor with us tonight, and her name is Ashley. And Ashley, I can't thank you enough for being here with us tonight, and admire the tremendous amount of courage that you have in coming forward and talking about this issue. Tell us, if you will, what you're comfortable with in terms of sharing your experience in this topic.
Yeah. Well, mine probably started out, I'm gay. And I didn't come from a very accepting family of that. And so when I left home for the first time, I got into a relationship with someone very abusive. And that relationship went on for about 5 years. And the abuse was pretty rough. And it ended up putting me into a very, very negative position, into a sex industry, actually, which, you know, the only thing I could say was that I was completely broken at the time. My spirit, my soul, everything was broken. I became an addict to compensate for the fact that I was broken. And then one day I went on a call and I went in a room, and I always thought I was in control, and control is an illusion. And I said, no, I'm not doing this. And I went to leave, and he didn't let me leave. And to this day, I can't remember his face or anything. I remember the carpet. And I hate carpet to this day. When I bought my house, I took all the carpet out. And for a long time, no one knew, because who was going to believe me? I mean, I was a drug addict. I was a prostitute who was being beaten on a regular basis by her girlfriend. And I couldn't tell my family. I mean, they already hated me for being gay. I mean, so how do you do that? And finally, after the person I was with set me up and got me arrested, I realized something had to change. And so I came clean about being a prostitute to my family and being a drug addict, and started to attempt to get better. It was a long road. My next two relationships were abusive. Another one was physical. The other one was mental. Finally, though, I was able to get clean. I've been clean for right at 13 years. It was difficult to stay that way, I'm not going to lie, sometimes. Because I didn't know what it was like to be that way alone. Because when I got clean, I was in a relationship with someone. And when that relationship ended, I realized I had never been alone. I went from my parents' house to my girlfriend's house to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. And when I realized I had to do this on my own, that was a lot of demons to face. And I realized that, and I had to face the big demon in the room. And so I started seeing a counselor. and started working through those things. And it started getting better. I went back to school for the first time to go back. I went to work for a job I loved. I got to work with people, helping people, and things got better, and they continue to get better. So I don't look at myself as broken anymore, because I think our scars make us who we are, and I'm okay with who I am. So I think that's what's important to take away from being a survivor, is that you learn who you are and never let that person that did that to you take away who you are. They're a stepping stone into, I mean, or at least they were for me. It was a stepping stone into who I could be and how I can maybe make a difference. And I'm hoping that one day I will, you know. But it's baby steps, so.
And can I say something? I've known her for over 20 years, and I'm so incredibly proud of her.
That was Ashley, a sexual assault survivor. A little bit of her story. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm the host of Health Matters tonight. This is a live community forum. We were talking about sexual assault. As April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, you can call and ask questions if you're listening, or if you are live here in our studio audience, you can simply raise your hand and ask your question. We have a microphone that is available. For those who are not here in the studio audience, you can call. That number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet the question at RRR Public Radio. Let's go ahead and have our first audience question to the panel.
I have a statement and then I have a question. Ashley, thank you so much for sharing your story. I think it's very important that people hear that there is hope, because it is so difficult when you're in the middle of it to feel like there is no way out. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's good for people to hear that there is hope. So thank you. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I would like to, I've worked with SANE nurses and I've talked with SANE nurses, and I would like to hear a little bit about how SANE nursing differs from other kinds of nursing, and, you know, the evidence collection is so important, but also a lot of the techniques that y'all learn are so important to help heal the person even as they're going through this process. So I would love to hear kind of the process and just a little bit about what a SANE nurse does.
First of all, we can't do our job without the advocate. The advocates are there more so for the emotional end of it. Because the advocates are the first person that the victim comes in contact with after they show up to the emergency room. The advocates are there and they get to tell them their options, because all the victims are given the options. Either they can report it to law enforcement, they can be have a blind report performed, or they can just be treated medically. Of course, being treated medically is the most important aspect of all of it. For the evidence collection, we have a standard process that we have to go through, and that's where the education kicks in. Because not only do we have to collect the evidence, we have to collect it back in our mind of having to testify to how we collect it. And if we have to testify, we may have to testify, like I have a trial coming up next week that happened in 2013. I'm not sure if I even answered your question. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so you're really one of the first people that really comes into contact with a victim.
No, the advocate is, okay. And then if they decide that they do want law enforcement, then law enforcement gets in contact. Law enforcement ultimately is the one that decides that contacts us and gets us involved. So the victims actually come in contact with several people,
Okay. Well, speaking of law enforcement, Detective, how does that process move forward? Let's say an incident occurs. How do you get involved?
Normally, excuse me, we're either contacted by either the advocate will contact us, depending on it depends on how the victim will report initially. If they call law enforcement direct, patrol will go out, make contact initially. We'll call us, and then we'll determine if it's within a time frame that we can actually make a collection. Juvenile victims are usually 3 days, and adults are 5 days. Those are the windows that we normally go by for collection. Once that's determined, then we'll get them to whatever hospital they want to go to. And then once that's done, then an advocate will respond, and then the detective will respond. The other way that things progress is that they'll initially go to the hospital and report, and then the advocate is to respond. With an adult has a lot more options than a child has. And with those options are, as Melanie said, is one of them is if they want to do a collection but they don't want law enforcement involved, they have that option to do what we call a blind report. Law enforcement at no time will be contacted initially. They will go in, the nurse will do the exam if it falls within the time frame of collection. And once that's done, the victim will leave. The advocate will make sure they're safe and if they have a place to go. And then they will law enforcement will contact, the detective will, and we'll go up. And the only thing we're given is a number. That collection just has a number on it. And that's how we know that individual. We don't know anything about them or anything that took place. We know nothing. That goes back and we keep that for a year. That's state law. And that in that year period, they have the option then to come forward on a blind report. If it's a regular report, then we'll get involved. And of course, we'll go in and conduct an interview if they're capable of doing an interview at that point. We'll make a determination if it's within a collection, and then we'll contact our SANE nurse to come out. And once they come out, they'll process and collect all the evidence that they can collect, photograph, document, and then they'll turn that actual perk over to us. And we call it a perk. It's a personal evidence recovery kit. And that's all the evidence that the SANE has, and they will turn that over to us. It's all the DNA evidence. And then we'll take it back to our office and store. We have a secured storage area in our office at SPD.
So for our live audience here, as well as those listening, define what an advocate is in this scenario.
An advocate is a trained professional who goes into the emergency rooms and meet the victims of sexual violence. And what they do, they go in and tell them their options. If they're an adult, like Mike said, as children, they don't really have options because we're mandated reporting. And we also, it's kind of like, if you will, the praise and worship before the word go forth. So we go and kind of de-escalate any situation and tell them everything that's going to happen when the forensic nurse comes out. We have a packet of information to leave with them. We also do safety planning because, unfortunately, some perpetrators are family members or loved ones. So
how do individuals get in touch with advocates? What's that process?
We have a hotline number, 227-7900, that they can call. And we also have a hotline number in the Manny area, 256-6242.
And I know there's not a 911 operator on the panel, but I'm making the assumption that a 911 call is going to be able to be directed into the right hands.
Yes.
If that happens to be the case.
If they have no other information. If a victim contacts 911, then patrol is going to respond to whatever location that they're called to. Make sure that scene's safe, make sure that individual is safe, and then get what information they need to then proceed from there. If they need to go to the hospital, they need to go by ambulance, or if we need to take them, whatever the needs to be done, they're going to take care of it. And they're going to start the wheel if that's the way that the victim calls us. Yes, sir.
In the time from the incident to reporting, sounds very important. Tell us a little bit more about that, because we know that many of these incidents are not reported and people wait, correct? So let's let's emphasize the importance of timely reporting.
From our standpoint, from law enforcement standpoint, the quicker the better for us, because the more evidence we can collect, evidence and DNA starts to deteriorate over time. There's loss of it. People wash hands or take a bath and things like that. So the quicker we can get to that evidence, the better off it is. And it's better for the processing of the scene. It's not disturbed if we need to go to an actual scene and we have one. So the quicker, the better. The most important thing is that people report. We need people to report. One of the things that she mentioned earlier was that the numbers have increased over years, but I think it's a lot to do with people reporting more than it is necessarily the act occurring more. People are more aware of it because of shows like this and things that go on, Sexual Assault Awareness Month, that just makes it more prevalent in the community. People talk about it more, so that means that the more people are actually stepping up and reporting the incidents. So it's the most important thing is that people actually report. We get it documented, and then we collect the evidence. So the quicker, the better, of course, for the collection.
And Melanie, from the standpoint of, you know, the reporting process, I know some of the information that you provided to us, you actually, you know, give victims and their families some advice in terms of timely reporting, but also steps to take to make sure evidence is preserved. Correct.
Correct. If they
remind
can,
us of some of those
after they've been right after they've been assaulted, if they will go straight to the ER. Don't change clothes, don't eat or drink anything, don't use the bathroom, don't shower, take baths, and go to the hospital then. But I think there's a big misconception that a lot of people think that if they have eaten or drinking, if they have taken a shower or bath, if it has been a day or two, they think that there's no use in going and having a kit done, that they think that they've washed away all of the evidence, and that's not always true.
So preservation of evidence is very important, but don't let that stop you.
Absolutely.
If time does pass, go ahead and get that exam. This is Health Matters. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. The topic for tonight's discussion is sexual assault awareness. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. This is a live community forum here in the Red River Radio's studios. The number for your calls, if you would like to call and ask a question or make a comment, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. This is a sensitive topic with Adult Matters, and so listener discretion is advised. Grace, in your information, you had a number of community groups that were important in terms of Title IX training, or a number of groups in colleges where it's important for Title IX training in terms of faculty, students, friends, and family in terms of reporting. Describe, if you will, to us what that training is like. Is it optional? Is it mandatory? Who is it mandatory for?
Certainly. We have a training available for our whole campus community because Title IX applies to students as well as faculty and staff. Faculty, staff, and student employees are required to take an annual training so that they are refreshed and up to date on the information. Incoming students receive training through freshman orientation as well as their freshman seminar class, and our whole student population has an optional training electronic module that is available through their class management system. So it's just optional for them, and it's not required for the entire student body. But we try to make sure that our training is focused on bystander awareness and intervention so that it doesn't seem like we're treating all females as victims or all males as perpetrators, but that everyone is affected by this issue and everyone can be part of the solution.
And so with the data that's out there, there are certain peak periods during the year where sexual assaults occur, especially on campus, and that first year,
Yes. Right? Research indicates that the first 6 weeks of a student's experience in college, they're more likely to experience sexual misconduct. So that's why we have the targeted training at freshman orientation, and then they take that in their freshman seminar class, which is a class that most students take their first semester of college.
And Angela, from your standpoint, you, in your information, there's a number of groups that you outreach to as well, in terms of sports directors, the Greek community, the faith community. Speak a little bit about that in terms of what, you know, our community leaders can do out there to increase the awareness of this issue, not only in the immediate reporting, as we've talked about, but also prevention and recognizing maybe when issues do need to be brought out into the open.
Okay. Well, during Sexual Assault Awareness Month, nationally, they indicated that the four populations that they wanted to reach out to, engaging new voices as a theme, were parents, Greek life, faith leaders.
Coaches,
yes. How could I forget that? and I think these people are the most influential in the lives of not just children, but other people, other peers, other colleagues. So their ideas or their conceptions of sexual violence and other things weighs heavy on the people that they're around. So I think it's important that they kind of get educated on these things, because think about the coaches. Their athletes need to know that it's not okay to have locker room talk about hurting girls or other boys even.
And so what do those conversations actually need to sound like in terms of if you have, you know, maybe volunteer coaches out there or people in Greek life or in the faith community? Give us an example or two, if you will, about what those conversations do need to sound like with their athletes or members.
I think the conversations need to sound like respect and inclusion. And also, with change in the rape culture, how society normally blames victims, it's important to hold a perpetrator accountable. So those are some conversations I think that should be talked about when we talk about sexual violence, because society tends to blame the victim. What were you wearing? Why are you in that neighborhood?
And, you know, there's victim blaming as well in culture. You know, it can be popular even in amongst social media circles, as well as, you know, even in the popular culture. So that's an important target, I would
absolutely
imagine.
That's why it's so important to go educate, because, you know, different people get their values from relationships at home or what they see on TV. So they need to know the correct way of what a healthy relationship looks like and what consent is.
And so just don't let these issues just sort of go by. It's not funny. You know, I don't know if you guys travel much, but you can't go to a stand-up comedy show anymore and not hear that, as at least every other joke has to do with something, you know, sexual. And so it's an easy way to trigger humor. And so folks who want to be funny, it's sort of low-hanging fruit, if you will. And so we have to understand that it's a very sensitive subject for many individuals.
I think it's important to educate them on it's not funny, because, I mean, it could be – it's no respect of persons. It can affect all of us. And with the statistics of 1 in 6 women and 1 in 33 men being a part of a complete or attempted rape in their lifetime, I mean, that's serious business. This is horrendous. It's life-altering. So it's no joking about it.
Let's go ahead and go to one of our audience members who has a question.
A lot of what has been talked about already are actions we can take as individuals to help our peers or colleagues be more aware about sexual assault. But I'm interested in hearing about our more systemic things. So if we brought it up to like a policy level, what are things that affect your direct role that you'd like to see occur to make changes in sexual assault reporting or awareness?
I'm gonna ask law enforcement to weigh in. Is there anything from the policy standpoint that comes to mind quickly that you see that could be implemented or changed in terms of what could bring more awareness to this issue, especially, you know, prevention and early reporting?
I think the biggest thing is we're educating and we're getting it out there. That's one of the most important things, because that is increasing the number of cases that we do work every year. So that means that more people are reporting. I don't think that we are increasing the number of incidents that are taking place. I believe people are reporting. One of the things that we tell people, even if they come in and talk to us, we've had people come in and talk to detectives about how they would work the case or whatever, or they report and they back out a few days later. We can't make people be a victim. We want them to report. We want them to help us and guide us through, you know, the process and get this individual into court and then into prison so they can, you know, start that journey down being a survivor instead of just being a victim. But we can't make them be a victim in an incident, so that's a problem, you know. I mean, it's not a problem, but we just can't force them to do that. So we encourage it. I mean, if people call or they want to report, and it's one of the I wanted to tell you too earlier, we were talking about a collection like a perk, not to get off topic, but if we're outside of time frame, that doesn't mean people can't still report. That doesn't mean a case still can't be worked. There's still evidence. There's still things we can collect to move forward. So it's important that people understand that too. If your case is 10 years old, report it. I've never had a person that reported something that regretted it. You just have people that don't report that regret it later. Well, no matter what the outcome of the case was.
And for the members here on the panel as well as in the audience who are in the university environment, you know, it seems like there's the random community risk that is universal, and then there's really concentrated risk, right, Angie? There's that first semester, that freshman, maybe someone who's had childhood trauma. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can line up risk factors, if we will. That's what we do in medicine. Mm-hmm. We look at risk factors for different occurrences of diseases, for example. Yeah. So alcohol, that's a big deal. First semester. Childhood trauma. So is there anything that is done from the risk factor standpoint institutionally or policy-wise to sort of put at-risk groups in prevention mode from day one? And the folks who are here in the university in the audience are certainly welcome to chime in as well. But Angie... Yeah. Thoughts that you might have.
Female college students age 18 to 24 are actually three times more likely to be sexually assaulted than the general population. So it's obviously a higher risk if you're talking risk. There are requirements, and I don't know the specifics very well, but with Greek life, they have certain requirements for their educational objectives. So sometimes, I know we had Angela come speak at a luncheon about sexual assault awareness last year. Those are certain requirements. If you're talking about answering the audience member's question earlier, financial funding is always a struggle with a state university in Louisiana, especially. So that's sometimes a struggle for our getting out there and campaigning and, you know, fortunately, Project Celebration helps us a lot, and that probably costs them, but we don't have to pay too much for that, and that's wonderful because we don't have the largest budget in the counseling office. So it's very important because they are at higher risk.
We have an audience member with a question or a comment.
It seems that most of the discussions about sexual assault tend to focus on the absence of consent as a defining factor, whether that absence be by the perpetrator using force or the victim being incapacitated. I wonder if the panel could comment on a recent finding that I saw in a survey done by researchers at Harvard. Out of 1,200 female respondents to the survey, one-third of them reported that they had been socially coerced into having sex with a overly persistent, relentless suitor. Now, that doesn't meet the legal definition, I wouldn't think. From my perspective, that individual could still be a victim, depending on what the consequences of that experience was for that individual. In other words, that they may have very similar psychological symptoms or sequelae from that experience. I wonder if the panel could comment on the issue of coercion as a form of sexual assault.
If you don't mind, I certainly would like to chime in. With gender social norms, we are sort of socialized in the dichotomy of male-female. I mean, obviously, with trans and LGBTQ population, that's a little different. But females are socialized to be a little more passive sexually and romantically. Males are socialized to be a little bit more assertive. And sometimes even when a female says no, the male thinks he's supposed to continue to try. So that makes it very complicated when we're talking about consent.
So when you're having discussions with people that you counsel, what advice would you give to those young women out there who obviously they want to socialize, they want to go on dates? That's normal. Mm-hmm. Alcohol is part of our culture. It's nearly unavoidable. So what recommendations would you have for those individuals out there to minimize their risk of being put in situations where they could be taken advantage of?
Well, there's certainly having a buddy system going on. There's some apps on your phone that you can download to help with that. If you're not at a certain location by a certain time, they can track you, things like that. Actually, Angela might be better to talk about rape culture in general, but most of the time when I speak with students, it's after the fact and trying to remove the self-blame that has already occurred.
Angela, she's tossed you the ball here.
Sorry. Can you repeat the
question? So from the, I guess we're really sort of looking at the date rape issue now, mm-hmm. On campus assaults. When the date becomes the victim, and how do we educate our young people, both potential victims and potential, perpetrators, and how to remain safe in their conduct and still have a good time?
Again, with education, we come in before, hopefully it doesn't happen, but we come in and do prevention talks and chats about how to stay safe. And like Angie was saying, it's an app that you can download called the Circle of Six. It takes up a lot of space on your phone, but it's really helpful. I downloaded it and we played with it and it actually works. You get six people in your circle who you trust. And if you're in a compromising situation, you push one button and a link goes out to everyone where you are. So that's pretty amazing if you care to use something like that.
Sort of like a panic button for,
yes.
for your phone.
Yes.
Interesting.
I think it's important also, like Angie said, to have a buddy system. Do some safety planning before you leave. Have a safe word. And just let people know where you're going in general. Just don't go by yourself.
And also, if friends... don't let friends drive drunk. Maybe friends don't let friends leave
yes.
the party with someone that they're not familiar with. Right.
Absolutely.
Another thing that I do, I have a daughter that's in her 20s, and I've taught her and her friends whenever they were teenagers, and she still does it now. Whenever they go out, that she makes sure, and she has her GPS on her phone. And I have access, but all of her friends do it, where somebody has access that's not with them. So in case they don't come home or whatnot, that person can look up and see where their phone is at least.
Where you're going, if you purchase drinks, you buy the drinks, you watch them poured, you set it down, you walk away from it, and then you're done with that drink, you get a new one. Just the best of their ability, monitor where they're at and what they're doing. Try to stay as alert and aware. If it's your night to drink, then you have somebody with you that's not. Not necessarily a designated driver if you're with a cab or something, but somebody that's there to help you. It just takes a split second if somebody puts something in your drink, and then you're done for the night. And that's one category, but just be around people that you know and that you trust, especially if you're going to meet new people that you're going to be hanging out with that you really don't know. And then the other problem is that it even occurs with people you do know. So just to the best of your ability, know your surroundings, who you're with, and monitor what you're drinking. And keep that, if you're drinking alcohol, to a moderate level.
That's a great point that the detective brings up, Angie, is most victims are victimized by people they are familiar with, correct?
True. It's 70 to 80% of perpetrators are known by the victim, which makes it much more complicated with reporting. There's the decision to report. If it was someone maybe they went on a date with, or a friend of a friend, or a classmate, someone they have to see again, the guilt or that the complicating factor there too of blaming why I shouldn't have been there with that person. It's a very difficult decision.
And also, a lot of the problem when people come forward is they say, well, I don't want to get that individual in trouble. Well, what occurred, that person did. You didn't do that. So if they get in trouble, that's their fault. It has nothing to do with the individual that's reporting. But it's a huge problem that we do see. You know, people get embarrassed and they're like, I don't want to get that individual in trouble.
I'll go ahead and give the number out. We may have time to take a question over the phone. It's 1-800-552-8502, and you can potentially tweet questions at RRR Public Radio. This is Health Matters, and it is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Again, the number is 1-800-552-8502. You know, Andrew, when we think about people who are victimized, there is that mention, as the detective brought up, of feeling guilty. How do victims deal with that guilt and the victim shame that tends to occur with this problem?
Well, they don't deal very well typically at first. So that self blame is part of the blame culture that we have too. But part of what I do with a student that comes to see me is, the shame is not yours. It's the person who did that to you. You shouldn't carry their shame. So we work with that. And with some of the symptoms with PTSD that come out of that, I mean, I've had student who had panic attacks in class because people were behind her in class. And that affects her academically. So she actually had a trusted professor she went to who told her about the assault. That professor contacted actually Grace with the Title IX coordinator and walked over to my office. And she was so nervous that she asked the professor to come in with her and sat with her in the office with me. And that's wonderful to see, that trust. I mean, the caring that our campus community has, and that's really important for parents to know, because this student maybe didn't want to report it, and she maybe didn't want to tell her parents, but at least she has someone she can go to when she is in college at this high-risk time, and this is a free service with tuition, so they don't have to worry about reporting that with insurance or anything. So that's really, really important, and we come in and we have so many people carrying that blame we can work on.
Yeah, and has it been your experience and the other psychologists that are here as well, that the longer that sort of, rests within the victim or doesn't rest, the more hazardous the outcome could be in terms of future relationships, academic performance, emotional well-being down the road?
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about the people talking, like the rape culture, making fun of that kind of thing, that, we have a student that gets triggered in the classroom, has to walk out, can't come back to class. Of course, that impacts them academically. They can't concentrate. They can't do their work. If they don't address these issues now, I mean, I want them to graduate. I want them to be successful in life. And if they can't get through that, it certainly impacts all relationships in their lives. And that's, sometimes those things trigger something from much earlier age. I've had that happen with students before, and they start having flashbacks from something that was years earlier, from overhearing someone talking about rape in a funny way. And that impacts every part of their lives.
We have another comment or question from the audience.
A comment. I As a treatment provider, I've found that sometimes people come to therapy and they don't even realize that they have been the victim of some kind of sexual assault. I've had people say, you know, something happened to me when I was a kid, and it's silly that I'm still bothered by it, and I don't know why I'm bothered by it. It's not a big deal. And then they tell me, and it is a big deal. And, you know, and I say, you're bothered by it because you were sexually abused. That's not okay what happened. And they're shocked. You know, because I wasn't held down, or there were no bruises, or there was no blood, or but you know, there doesn't have to be violence in order for it to be traumatizing and to impact all areas of your life.
And certainly, as a child, what is normal? They don't necessarily have that perspective yet. Down the road, as an adult, they may see it differently and then realize what happened, and that can reopen some old wounds and trigger some things too.
I think we have time for one more question from the audience or comment.
Yes. As a mental health professional, I'm very familiar with the term mandatory reporter, but could someone on the panel maybe give a good description of that for the audience?
I can explain that from the university standpoint, and then maybe somebody else can explain that from the legal standpoint. At LSU Shreveport, we consider all of our faculty and staff, except for a few exceptions, which I can explain, are responsible employees. So anytime they have or they receive a report from a student or a campus community member, they are required to notify the Title IX office. And we look into it, and it may or may not lead to a full investigation. And we certainly want to respect a individual's privacy if possible, but sometimes there's a pattern of behavior that needs to be addressed. But on our campus, those individuals who are not considered responsible employees are counseling services staff, and then we have a select few faculty and staff who've received some in-depth training, and they're considered confidential advisors, and students can seek their assistance without generating a report to our office.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks to all our panelists, Grace Nichols, Angie Pellerin, Angela Henderson, Melanie Hubbard, and Detective Michael Jones. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. And as you may have heard before, Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, consult a physician or a health professional. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not reflect those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or their staff. This show will be available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation, the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and a gift from Kit and Lisa Gamble. Please join us again here next Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.